Chapter 28. A freelance indeed, Mr. Bell. You've hit the nail on the head. But the possibility of a freelance merely raises the larger question. Abington Westlake's round face brightened with relief that he had so intrigued Bell that the tall detective would let him go. Whom does the freelance serve? Are freelancers commonly used in the spy game? Bell asked. One employs all available resources. Have you ever worked as a freelance? Abington Westlake smiled disdainfully. The Royal Navy hires freelancers. We don't work for them. I mean you personally, if you need money. I work for His Majesty's Navy. I am not a mercenary. He stood up. And now, Mr. Bell, if you will excuse me, I believe I have paid you for your photograph in equal coin. Agreed. Agreed, said Bell. Good day, sir. Before you go, Commander. What is it? I have been dealing with you in my capacity as a private investigator. As an American, however, let me warn you that if I ever again see or hear of you taking photographs of the Brooklyn Navy Yard or any other shipyard in my country, I will throw your camera off the bridge and you after it. Isaac Bell hurried upstairs to the Van Dorn office. A big case kept getting bigger and wider. If Abington Westlake was telling the truth, and Bell bet he was, then Yamamoto Kenta was not the head of the spy ring attacking Hull 44, but only another of its many agents. Like the German and the hired killer Weeks and whoever threw the young fire control expert off the cliff. Who was the freelance, and whom did he serve? Bell knew he was at a crossroads. He had to decide whether to arrest Yamamoto and squeeze what information they could out of him, or continue following him in the hope that the Japanese spy would lead them higher up the chain of deceit. There was risk in waiting. How long would it take a seasoned professional like Yamamoto to catch the scent of his stalkers and go to ground? As Bell strode into the back room, the man on the telephones said, "Here he is right now, sir, just walked in," and handed him the middle one. "The boss." "Where?"
"Washington."
"Yamamoto just hopped the train to New York," Van Dorn said without preamble. "Coming your way." "Alone?" "Not if you count three of our men in the same car, and others watching every station the Congressional Limited stops at. I'll watch the railroad ferry. See who he's come to meet." Yamamoto Kenta had a choice of three different Pennsylvania Railroad ferries to cross the river from the Jersey City Exchange Place terminal to Manhattan Island. After disembarking from the Congressional Limited into the enormous glass-ceilinged train shed, he could take a boat to 23rd Street, another to Desbrosses Street near Greenwich Village, or one that would land all the way downtown at Cortlandt Street. There was even a boat to Brooklyn, and another went up the East River to the Bronx. The ferry he chose would depend upon the actions of the Van Dorns following him. He had spotted two detectives in his rail car, and he suspected that an older man dressed as an Anglican priest had shadowed him several days earlier, disguised in the uniform of a Washington, D.C. streetcar conductor. He had considered jumping off the train early at Philadelphia and dodging the Van Dorns watching the platform, but with so many alternatives awaiting him in New York, he saw no need to inconvenience himself by breaking the journey early. It was after midnight, and the crowd rushing from the train shed was thin, providing less cover than he would have liked. Still, the advantage was his. The detectives did not realize that he knew they had been following him for a week. A thin smile played upon his lips. A natural aptitude for spying, or simply experience. He'd been at the game before many of the shadows trailing him had been born. As always, he traveled light, carrying only a small valise. The Black Ocean Society had limitless cash reserves. He could buy extra clothing when he needed it instead of carrying it when a situation like this one demanded he move quickly. His gabardine raincoat was of a tan hue, so pale as to be almost white. His hat was of a similar distinctive color, a finely woven Panama with a dark band. At the juncture of the train platform and the arrival hall, he saw the Anglican priest forge ahead and signal a tall man whom Yamamoto had last seen in Camden, New Jersey. Frantic research back in Washington, sparked by his discovery that he was being followed, led him to believe that the Van Dorn was the fabled Isaac Bell. Bell had worn a white suit and broad-brimmed hat at the Michigan launching. Tonight he was attired like a deckhand in a snug sweater with a knit watch cap covering his striking golden hair. Yamamoto smiled to himself. Two could play that game. Swept along by the torrent of passengers and trunk-trundling porters, Yamamoto followed the signs from the arrival hall into the ferry house. A row of ferries waited in their slips. Magnificent Tuscan red, smoke-belching, two-deck double-ender behemoths big as dreadnoughts and named for great American cities. Cincinnati, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Chicago. Engines ahead, propellers pushing them tight to their piers, they offered the Japanese spy additional choices of which deck to travel on. Teams of draft horses, iron shoes clattering, were pulling freight wagons aboard the lower vehicles' decks, vast open spaces they shared with autos and trucks. Foot passengers could ride beside them, separated by the bulkheads of flanking passenger cabins that ran the length of the boat. The main cabins were above. As a first-class passenger, Yamamoto could enjoy the brief river crossing in a private cabin. There was one cordoned off for gentlemen, another for ladies. Or he could stand in the open air where the salty harbor wind would disperse the smoke and cinders. He chose a ferry not for its destination, but for the fact that its deckhands were already closing its scissor gate, blocking any more passengers from boarding. "Not so fast, chink boy," a burly deckhand shouted in his face. Yamamoto already had $10 in his hand. The man's eyes widened at his good fortune, and he reached for it, shouting, "Step lively, sir, step lively!" Yamamoto slid past him and moved deeper into the boat, heading for the stairs to the upper deck at a rapid clip. The whistle blew a sharp tenor note. The deck stopped shuddering as the screws holding her in place stopped turning. Then the enormous boat shook from stem to stern as the screws reversed to drive her out of her slip. Yamamoto reached the ornamentally carved wooden staircase that swept upward in a graceful curve. For the first time, he looked back, a quick glance over his shoulder. He saw Isaac Bell running full speed to the edge of the slip. At the edge, the detective launched himself in the air in an attempt to broad jump the rapidly widening gap. The Japanese spy waited to confirm that Bell had fallen in the churning water. Isaac Bell landed gracefully as a gull, strode to the scissor gate, and engaged the deckhands in conversation. Yamamoto ran up the stairs. He showed his train ticket to enter the first-class gentleman's lounge, headed for the men's room, entered a stall, and closed the door. He turned his tan coat inside out, revealing its black lining. His hatband was formed by multiple layers of tightly wound silk. He unwound it into a long scarf, bent the brims of his Panama downward, and tied it on his head with the scarf. The final touch was packed in his valise. Then all he had to do was wait when the ferry docked until all the men had left the first-class cabin. He had just opened his valise when beneath his feet the rumble of the screws abruptly stopped. Forward momentum slowed so quickly he had to brace against the wall. The whistle gave three short blasts. The screws rumbled anew, shaking the deck. And to Yamamoto's horror and disbelief, the giant ferry backed out of the river and into the terminal slip from which it had just emerged. The loudest of the hundreds of the Pennsylvania Railroad ferry passengers inconvenienced was a United States senator. He roared like an angry lion at the ferry captain. "What in blue blazes is going on here? I've been traveling all day from Washington, and I'm late for a meeting in New York." No one dared ask a senator traveling without his wife whom he was meeting at midnight. Even the ferry captain, a veteran North River waterman, was not brave enough to explain that a Van Dorn detective dressed like a deckhand had barged into his wheelhouse and drawn from his wallet a railroad pass unlike any he had ever seen. The document required all employees to accord him privileges of the line that exceeded even that of a senator who voted religiously in favor of legislation the railroads approved. Handwritten and signed and sealed by the president of the line and witnessed by a federal judge, it superseded all dispatchers. Its only limits were common sense and the rules of safety. "What did you do to get that pass?" the captain had asked as he hurriedly signaled the engine room, "Stop engines." "The president returned a favor," said the detective, "and I always tell the president how kindly I am treated by his employees." So the captain told the legislator, "A mechanical breakdown, Senator." "How the devil long are we going to wait here?" "Everyone is disembarking for the next boat, sir. Let me carry your bag." The captain seized the senator's valise and led him to the main deck and down the gangway, where cold-faced detectives observed every passenger trooping off. Isaac Bell stood behind the other Van Dorns, watching over their heads each and every face. The manner that Yamamoto had chosen to get away, jumping aboard at the last instant, made it clear that the shadows had slipped up and the Japanese spy knew he was being followed. Now, it was a chase. 380 passengers, men, women, and sleepy children, shuffled past. Thank the Lord, thought Bell, it was the middle of the night. The boats carried thousands at rush hour. That's the last of them. Okay, now we check every nook and cranny on the boat. He's hiding somewhere. A small elderly woman in a long black dress, a warm shawl, and a straw bonnet tied to her head with a dark scarf boarded a streetcar outside the Jersey City Exchange Place terminal. It was a slow stop-and-start ride to the city of Hoboken. The trolley looped around the square at Ferry and River Streets, and now her journey moved swiftly as she descended to the first completed of the McAdoo tubes. For a nickel, she boarded an 8-car electric train so new it smelled of paint. It whisked her under the Hudson River. 10 minutes after boarding, she left the tube train at the first station in New York. The conductors operating the air-powered doors exchanged a glance. The neighborhood at Christopher and Greenwich Streets, above the beautifully lighted vaulted ceilings of the tube line, was nowhere near as pleasant as the subterranean station, particularly at such a late hour. Before they could call a warning, the woman hurried past a pretty florist's shop at the foot of the stairs, closed, with lights still shining on the flowers, and disappeared. At street level, she found a dark square of grimy cobblestones. Warehouses loomed over formerly genteel residences long since partitioned into rooming houses. She drew the attention of a thug who followed her, drawing close as she neared an alley. She whirled suddenly, pressed a small pistol to his forehead, and said in a soft male voice with a slight accent the thug had never heard before, "I can pay you handsomely to guide me to a clean room where I can spend the night, or I can pull the trigger. I will let you choose."